So if anyone in the audience has questions for any of our speakers, two microphones in the room. Dr. Henley will join us as well.
But you didn't talk too much about what those benefits are. The subtext, what I understood, was that it's to generate income, which is what can be good for the farmers and is obviously of interest for the different companies that might be involved. But since we're talking about food security, I'd like to suggest that maybe income is something that is, of course, of interest to the farmers, but might not be the whole picture of what can really strengthen the households and the community. So, what kind of thinking is going into that side of things?
It's a great question. And the reason I didn't specify is because it's project dependent. But your point is absolutely valid, that it's usually a multifaceted outcome that you're going for. To give a more specific example, most of my work recently has been on the Feed the Future work at USAID. And the goals there are both income and nutrition. So you have to then reduce vulnerability to shocks, right? So then you have to trade off. Do you go after something like coffee, cash crop, where they're going to have increased income? Do you believe that's going to reduce their vulnerability? Do you believe that will translate to increased nutrition, and why? So in each of the countries that we worked in, we had to do that analysis. In some countries, we could see a correlation of actually, when income goes up, we do see a correlation, they purchase more nutritious foods, they're sending their kids to school. In other countries, that link was not there. Guatemala, actually, strangely, income goes up, nutrition goes down, because they're buying chips and soda and things like that. So then we have to increase additional interventions to try to make sure we get the outcomes we want. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, a short comment. In the presentation I made yesterday, I talked a lot about how crop diversity is something really important to maintain within farming systems. And one of the best things that's happened in our program in Ethiopia in terms of market linkages was an Ethiopian entrepreneur that opened up a pasta factory, the first one in Addis. And what that meant is that it created a market for local durum wheat varieties. The farmers have been planting for generations, but the farmers in these same regions, the only way that they had been able to really generate income on national markets before that was by producing bread wheat, which was nutritionally and in terms of their own household consumption, what was really impoverishing, really, their families from a nutritional point of view. So,
absolutely. Yeah. And you also have to think about sustainability from both the diversity of production perspective and income perspective, but also from an environmental perspective as well.
Hello, my name is Felix von Geyer. I'm a sustainable development journalist and also lecturer in energy and sustainability at Concordia. Unfortunately, having two children, I missed both the McKinsey and the Syngenta presentations, and I so much wanted to hear them. So I'm just really going to address Eugene Terry, but there will be some overlap for you guys, I know. We talked about, obviously, the need for increased yields and disease-free seeds, etc. How much of this can actually be achieved without going the genetically modified route? How much genetically modified technology is acceptable, for example, gene switching? And also, how much of this, really picking up on the other lady's point, would be for domestic consumption as opposed to export? And how much will therefore be contingent on a good outcome on the Doha round? Thank you.
Let me take the first part of the question, which was directed to my presentation. First of all, just to keep the record straight, the improved potato varieties coming from the SIG breeding program are not genetically modified. They were developed through conventional plant breeding techniques. If we want to at least spend a minute or so to talk about the pros and cons of actually achieving levels of performance in terms of yields, either through gene action or through conventional plant breeding, my recommendation would be to start from the point of view of, first and foremost, do we have a problem? Do we have a problem of declining productivity? If we do have a problem of declining productivity, what are the root causes? What are the major factors that contribute to declining productivity? Among them would be inadequate levels of resistance to diseases and pests, and other performance characteristics, some of which can be rectified through conventional breeding. When, in fact, you cannot rectify these through conventional breeding, then among the many, many tools that you may want to look at would be genetic modification. It is then and only then that it becomes an appropriate question to ask whether genetic modification is the way to go. But it is certainly not the first question to ask. And the point of departure is, do we have a problem of declining productivity?
Thank you. As I said, I'm Aiden from the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. My question is directed mainly at Catherine Young. It's in relation to these PPP models that you mentioned. I'm keen to know if these models operate within a given legal framework that is binding to make sure that, you know, both parties meet their own end of the deal. The reason I'm saying this is that, again, we caught two cases from Zim of PPP. One was in the cotton production, where there are three major players. One of the players invested in farmer training, input and credit schemes and the like. Then at marketing time, the other two guys came in and offered a price that was higher, and everything went to these two players. And the same thing also happened to the small water irrigation guys with vegetable production from the cane factories again. One company invests in the training and so on, then others sit back at harvesting time, they come in, they offer higher prices, and they lose the business. So, you know, the legal framework. Thank you.
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point. I mentioned the risk, you know, that the businesses don't benefit the smallholders. There's equal risk on the other side, that the businesses invest in the smallholders, prices go up, and the smallholders sell on the side to somebody else after the businesses have made the investment. There are ways to manage that risk and mitigate that risk. Some of the models we've seen that work are exactly as you were saying. How do you get the government to lead this process so that you actually have a legal framework to operate in? How do you have a social sector actor step up and provide the insurance for both sides? Not only the monitoring, but the insurance. So in the event of I think I know which cotton example you're talking about, but in the event that happens, what are the insurance mechanisms in place to mitigate the risk with both the private sector and the smallholders. But you're absolutely right, and that's why I made it a point to talk about the contract mechanisms, because it's really actually quite difficult and necessary to make sure that you're monitoring both sides of the equation.
I've been reminded that I didn't make a comment about whether the potatoes were for domestic consumption or as an export crop. I believe that currently most of the potatoes that are produced both in Kenya and in Tanzania are for domestic consumption, but one understands also that the market for potatoes are opening up in South Africa, and therefore I think some of these potatoes would probably be going into that market. But I imagine that there's a huge potential and a huge market for domestic consumption right now.
Good morning. My name is Virginie Barrière. I am a PhD student in neuropsychology at McGill. I have a question for Catherine Young. I was wondering, in the example you gave with the suppliers to Starbucks and the coffee producer, all of this coffee producer needs to be certified in the ISO 20,000, something like that. And if yes, how would you deal with that?
Again, that's actually very project specific. It's a great point. A lot of times you need to have a certification, whether it's ISO or environmental sustainability, or you have to have traceability for export purposes. The way you deal with that is you make sure you're aware of that in the upfront assessment, and you build that into the economics. The fact is, the certification programs are extremely costly. They have their benefits, and there's great upsides as well, but they're extremely costly, and that's part of the economic analysis that has to happen. What do you have to do to meet that level of certification, and is that possible for the smallholders to do? And if it is, and it just requires an extra year or two of investment or work, fantastic. If it makes it unattainable, you look at a different crop or a different value chain system.
There are no other questions from the floor. I wanted to push on one point that it was Sarah that asked the first question, but you, Catherine, but I'll ask all of the panelists. This question of balance between income generation and nutrition for smallholder farmers. Are there any tools or mechanisms to try and strike that balance so that in setting up these 3P partnerships, we don't actually follow the 20th century mode of going to monocropping? So I guess the question is, how do we ensure that we have crop diversity while we're still trying to enroll and engage smallholders in improve crop productivity that has income potential?
Well, I'm not always sure the trade-off is as stark as people think. They're certainly there for the first few years, right? I mean, you're certainly making a year of trade-off, whether you're growing a soybean to increase, to improve the soil yield. In the end, it improves the economics. So I think the way you do it is you make sure you're taking a long-term view. If you're taking a 2 or 3 year view, yeah, you're going to end up with monocropping. You're going to say, smallholders should grow whatever makes the most money in the market this year. You're taking a long-term view. You might have to invest a few more years, but you need to help the smallholders understand that, diversifying your crops has soil benefits, has, actually stability benefits. You have something, if your price is at one fall, you can sell the other one, and actually is a long-term pays off for them.
And smallholders continue to make provision for their nutritional requirements, even if it's still a small part of the enterprise and their production system. And so they do not immediately jump into the new mode of monocropping simply to maximize profit and income. They do look after that. I would imagine that those who invariably would decide that they're going to go monocropping would have to make other arrangements to satisfy that, including using that income generated from the monocrop to provide themselves with that. But I think they invariably would like to ensure and assure themselves that their own nutritional needs are met. And so a small part of it is still devoted to that.
Yeah, I think it'd be hard to get them to grow one crop, actually.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank the speakers, not initially for the presentations, but for exercising excellent economy of time, keeping us right on the time schedule. But I hope this session has been informative for the audience as well. I think the speakers have given some really outstanding examples of where the private sector can fit in and actually, in some cases, be the bridge between the technology and productivity by smallholders. And Mr. Menard also, I think, did an excellent example of how federated state and provincial governments have an important role to play in these development activities as well. With that, I hope you'll join me in thanking all of our speakers this morning.